Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Bonjour, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, flirtatious gunrunner Lady P, no relation to Master P. And on the lam with me is my partner in crime, renowned tourist swindler, Mr. Martin Kessler.
We never understood each other.
And getting in on the excitement is an international film critic of mystery. She'll steal your heart and then she'll steal your car. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Miss Monica Castillo.
Hello.
On today's show, doom romance is in the air because we're talking about the 43rd movie on the Sight and Sound Greatest of All Time list, Jean-Luc Godard's Perrault le Fou. Huh? Oh boy. Is Perrault le Fou worthy of its esteem? And will I let the fact that I cannot for the life of me pronounce the title influence my overall impression? Listen up to find out. Then it's the Oscars. Yep, we're going to talk about it. We've waited a while to get into the action, but it's finally time for us to weigh in on all the excitement. Excitement question mark. And we're going to talk about all the mishigas surrounding this year's award season. Then, before we go down in a blaze of glory, we'll close things out with a few final notes of positivity. All right, guys, shall we punch out the gas station attendants and hit the road? Yes!
That's
up on your Laurel and Hardy, all right. First up, we have Jean-Luc Godard's 1965 feature, Perrault le Fou. Perrault le Fou? How's that?
I'm not even going to try. Yeah. That's how
that's
that is.
That's good enough. All right. Perrault le Fou opens with Godard regular Jean-Paul Belmondo in a bathtub reading aloud to his cherubic daughter, when suddenly a shrewish female voice interrupts the history lesson and the child is whisked away. The voice, it turns out, is that of the Belmondo character's wife. It seems she's very unhappy with her husband because he's not dressed for some party. She then demands to know what happened to the babysitter. Belmondo dries himself off and explains defensively that he sent her to the movies to go see Johnny Guitar. This is the moment that it dawns on all those watching Perrault le Fou that they could instead be watching Johnny Guitar. At this point, all sensible folks head over to their DVD shelf, pop in the Joan Crawford classic western, and have themselves a glorious afternoon. Seriously, Jean-Luc, invoke the name Johnny Guitar with caution. What are you doing? Anyway, all the dedicated souls with superhuman levels of willpower who soldier on with Perrault will encounter this. Belmondo plays a guy named Ferdinand who, much to his chagrin, is sometimes addressed as Perrault. Ferdinand fancies himself a great thinker, someone who's going to transform the world through his writing, if only he could just break free from the trappings of his comfortable middle-class existence. The wife, the kids, the apartment, the job offers that just fall into his lap. Oh, how bourgeois. One evening, after the particularly boring party that I mentioned a second ago, Ferdinand's salvation arrives in the form of his former lover turned babysitter, Marianne, played by Godard's then-wife and frequent muse, Anna Karina. Shortly after Ferdinand and Marianne reignite their affair, it is revealed that Marianne has run afoul of some paramilitary gangsters. And by that I mean she murdered one of them so she could steal his cash. As you can imagine, the gangster's friends don't take too kindly to being ripped off, and now they want revenge. Ferdinand helps Marianne escape and pledges to run away with her. Their madcap adventure takes them all over France. But their promise to remain together begins to unravel when it is revealed that Marianne is in love with someone else, a man that she'd previously referred to as her brother. Turns out she's been using Ferdinand as a pawn the entire time. And so there you have it. Love is an illusion, and life holds no great mystery. So Ferdinand goes and shoots Marianne and her lover slash brother. Then he gets a bunch of dynamite and blows himself up. The end. Or is it? Okay, I apologize if my synopsis sounds glib or simplistic, but that's kind of the idea. In my mind, a fawning scene-by-scene breakdown of Perrault le Fou would be inappropriate. And missed the point. A haphazard, jokey, piss-take seems more aligned with the way Godard tells the story. A little sarcastic, a little sincere, very self-referential, silly, and ultimately pretty charming. But charming enough for the 43rd spot. Let's discuss. Okay, Monica. Put you on the spot here. Do you like Perrault le Fou?
I do.
Okay, all right. Martin, how about you?
Yeah.
Yeah!
I think like all good dark films, I have kind of a mixed reaction to it.
Okay.
Like, it's a film full of contradictions, like the whole tender and cruel, usual, unusual thing going on. Like, that's all the way through the film. But I like its inventiveness. I like when it's being playful. Visually, I think it's one of Godard's more striking films. But it's also kind of frustrating. So,
Yeah. So, Monica, maybe elaborate a little bit. What do you like about it?
Well, and the number of times that I've seen it, and I admit I'm not as hardcore as some of the other Godard heads out there, but I have revisited Pierre Le Fou quite a few times, and each time that I sit down to watch it, I pick up on something new. And being able to still watch the same movie multiple times and still find something new to discover and realize, oh, wow, that was really clever, that gives me reason to keep revisiting it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, are you generally a Godard fan? I mean, you're not a hardcore one, but...
Truth be told, I'm more of a Truffaut girl, but...
It's not either or, but yes, Truffaut's better.
I know this is like a Chaplin-Keaton debate.
It is. You can like both, but you always... Everyone secretly has a preference. We shouldn't pit them against each other. We shouldn't do that. Fight the urge. Anyway, but so... I think Godard is probably one of the most polarizing figures in cinema history. I think you generally either like him or appreciate him, or you cannot stand him. But it sounds like that maybe the conventional wisdom that says you either like him or hate him is not the case, because this film is... We all have kind of mixed reactions to it. Like, we accept it on its face. We accept what Godard is doing, and yet is there something about the way the film, like, it's totally on his terms and we accept it on his terms, but do we still have problems with it in spite of, like, how it's meant to be taken?
I mean, you know what I mean? It's not a cuddly film. It's not the feel-good movie you want to reach for when you're getting over a breakup, my God.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe you do.
I mean, all the more power to you.
Yeah.
But I think part of that is because that Godard made this right after he split with his muse, Karina. And I think there's that underlying sense of bitterness, which is, you know, we can tap into that, but it's not... And it's just distancing between that, between the way the narrative flows, or non-narrative, whatever what you want to call it. It's not the most easiest, you know, gung-ho movie to get in line for.
I think also, too, like, a lot of the things that were sort of revolutionary about the film have been kind of internalized into mainstream cinema, and like a lot of art house filmmakers who have borrowed from it and built on it. So I think like some of it might not be as wowing as when the film was first released. Like I think some of Godard's more recent films might actually like speak to me more, because I think they're responding to films that are coming out right now. Like this feels... like, of course, very foundational, because you see it in, like, Wong Kar Wai films or Takashi Kitano films, or even, like, Tony Scott films borrow from this. So, you know, it's like, it's a little bit hard to put myself in the mindset of what it would have been like to watch this in 1965.
I don't think that really deflates from its influence, however. I mean, the fact that
I don't think it deflates. I just think, like,
I don't know. I'm just used to going back to seeing silent movies and being wowed by the fact that they were able to accomplish so much. I still look back at movies like Pierre Le Fou and I'm like, wow, the colors, the composition. I'm thrilled with the creative use of just everything that Godard throws at the wall at this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Martin, why do you think, is it the distancing effect of the, you know, I take your pick, the fourth wall breaking, the randomly inserting comic strips.
I love the fourth wall breaking. I think it's actually... I mean, that's the stuff I really love about the film, and I think it's actually when it becomes more conventional that it's not as interesting to me. Like, for a film that breaks down all these conventions and crime genre tropes, whatever, for like an hour and a half in to start falling back into those tropes and start playing out, like, it's not so different from a film of that genre, it's a little bit frustrating that it kind of expects you to get invested at a certain point. So, like, I sort of struggle with that towards the end of the film.
Right. I guess that's part of my issue with the film. Like, how seriously are we meant to take the romance, and how much are we meant to get invested in the characters? Because there is this distancing effect that, Monica, you talked about, and it's achieved through a number of means. There are scenes where he just completely glosses over the action and, like, takes it for granted that the audience knows what's going on. I kind of find it really funny. I didn't think it's meant to be funny, but it functions kind of as a parody of a gangster movie or a Love on the Run kind of story. That's Truffaut. Oops. Or like a road movie. It sort of accepts that the audience knows these conventions and then plays with them. So it's really, I don't know, it's kind of like, is it like maybe a little too clever for its own good? I sort of sometimes feel that way.
I feel that he's playing, and this is a theme that reoccurs throughout the movie, that he's playing with reality and fantasy. The fantasy that, you know, Pierre/Ferdinand can just run away with the babysitter. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a dude fantasy. Going for the younger woman.
Right.
And just running away with her, and everything's going to be okay. And then, yeah, she really loves you. Oh, sure. You know, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And then the reality of that was that she was using him. So I think it's not just in the story, it's also in different scenes and sequences, like, is this real, is this fake? The movie within the movie sequence when they're making fun of the Americans to their face, you know, different things like that.
Yeah. Martin, how much do you get emotionally invested in the film?
Barely at all. I think I sort of like the bit where Samuel Fuller's has this little cameo in the film, and he says that cinema is, in a word, emotion, and this film is so far removed from, like, real emotion that I assume that Godard is sort of responding to that. But I almost prefer Godard when, like, it's purely cerebral and there's, like, no reason at all to get invested. But I think there's times where I feel like I should, but I'm not, and I don't know, it's a little awkward, I find, on that level. Yeah.
There's little moments where there's, like, little flirtations, like when she sings the song and they're just walking through the woods.
Yeah,
or in the morning when she's making him the breakfast, takes a cigarette puff, that's also reminiscent of Breathless.
Right.
I think he has those little pockets, and I guess that's what I'm able to glom onto.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because, as we mentioned, Godard and Carino were kind of in the process of breaking up as they were filming this movie. So I would assume that there is some genuine emotion, like Godard is trying to convey some genuine emotion or say something about romance, but it is so cerebral. But also he's so cynical about romance.
In this one in particular, like in comparison to Breathless, which I think is a lovely movie, it's completely different tones.
Yeah, yeah. Breathless feels like a love story. This feels like someone tired of telling love stories, right?
Or turning the love story on its ear.
Yeah.
I was just thinking, this wasn't the last film that they made together, right? I was just wondering if...
No, they did one more.
Like, I think Made in USA was after this.
Yeah. It was, yeah. Can you... I can't even imagine.
I mean, maybe that explains that movie.
Yeah, exactly. It's amazing. I don't know how they're able to do that after they'd broken up, make another movie together. And especially considering, I'm surprised she agreed to make this movie you can tell me I'm wrong, but there's so much, it's so clear he feels so much resentment towards that character.
Women, right?
Women.
Between the wife, who's kind of a shrew, and like he makes her out to be that, to the sort of, you know, she's not a manic pixie dream girl, but she's loose enough that she's like a serious kind of streak in that sort of regard, where she's whimsical but still, like, enchants him with that possibility and that fantasy.
Maybe it's about the destruction. I mean, not maybe, it is about the destruction of that fantasy. So I think it's, I mean, I'm kind of critical of the way Godard depicts the Marianne character, but I think he's probably equally critical of Ferdinand for letting himself fall victim to this fantasy.
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, there's just this streak of misanthropy in all of his movies. Like, he gets a lot of flack for his female characters, but I think he's pretty contemptuous of everybody, right?
I think that's a fair assessment.
Yeah.
Equally angry at all.
Exactly, yeah.
Cross with everyone in the room.
But one thing that this film kind of props up, and I'm wondering if maybe we can talk about whether it plays with this convention at all, but you see it in a lot of Godard films where you have the male who's kind of this intellectual, all about ideas, versus the female who's all about feelings. And there's that scene where they're playing on the beach, or Ferdinand is writing, and Marianne comes up to him and talks about how they have nothing in common. And they talk about their separate interests. And I mean, it's sort of clear that they're coming, that it's meant to be like she's into feelings and he's into ideas. She's into words.
Like, it's also interesting, though, that, like, I think in some ways the film is meant to be like an adventure away from logic. Like, it's, there's that quote at the very beginning, or maybe it's not a quote, it's just the talking at the beginning about Vasquez sort of abandoning form and stopping to paint objects and trying to, like, achieve something infinite. And it seems like at parts this movie's about trying to abandon form and logic and pursue the sort of irrational, illogical, but it's also just, I think it keeps falling back into these like little intellectualisms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How seriously are we meant to take Ferdinand's artistic pursuits? I don't know. Maybe it's because it's played by Belmondo. I can't take it seriously at all. I mean,
maybe it's supposed to be as serious as the director in 8 and a Half.
Yeah.
Where it's like, yeah, that's his goal, but we don't actually see him achieving it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a lot of talk, like, I will write.
Yeah.
And then not much comes of that.
Exactly. But at one point, the director in 8 and a Half made something of note. Could you ever see Ferdinand making
something? No, he's
going
to be the French novelist who's always going to be working on his first book.
Exactly, yeah. That's sort of my impression.
He's going to yell at people why they haven't heard of Balzac.
Yeah.
At all the parties.
So another aspect of this film that we should probably address is Godard tries to at least somewhat tackle more contemporary political and socioeconomic issues. Now, he wasn't exactly a stranger to this. One of his first films addressed military concerns. Les Petits Soldats. I think that's how you pronounce it. But, so it's clearly something that's like, that's been on his mind. And it's, I've read biographies that say this was kind of a turning point in his career, where from this point going forward, he would start to incorporate more and more Maoism and more Marxism and all that stuff. Plus, we directly address the Vietnam War and I think the Algerian War, I think.
Yeah, see, yeah. I was kind of curious about that because I missed the Algerian War reference. Mm. It might be something that he references in another movie, but obviously the Vietnam one is like name dropped.
Yeah.
And we hear a radio broadcast sort of thing. We see that Ferdinand sees it in the movie theater, and of course they do that little play for the American soldiers.
Right.
Yeah,
right,
it's very overt.
Exactly.
Even though somehow I managed to forget about it after a couple years of seeing it.
Yeah.
I only just remembered, oh, the little love story or so. And then I'm like, oh right.
Yeah.
It gets serious. And it's weird because it's such a nonsensical.
Kind of felt that way too.
Oh, sorry.
No, I kind of felt the same way. Like, I think last time I saw this, it was sort of sandwiched in between like a few of Godard's later 60s films. So I just remember basically the love plot and of course the ending, but watching it, I kept thinking some of these things were like from Made in USA or two or three things I knew about her. Like, I didn't realize they were from this film, so it was sort of like a weird surprise every time that they came up.
Yeah. But do you think he incorporated it well? Did it make sense? Or, I mean, the film is such a hodgepodge, like, I feel like he could have thrown in anything and it would have made
sense.
It's
weird that, like, they talk about oh yeah, how removed we are from the war, hearing about these statistics. They don't mean anything to us. We don't know anything about the people. And then it never really tries to bridge that. And like with the relationship with the characters on screen, it's also sort of like we talked a little bit before about how distant it feels. I wondered if maybe that's him commenting on the distance we feel, or if he just can't bridge that gap, or I don't know how you guys feel about it, but
I think it's a kind of self-critique in the fact that they don't take this information as seriously. And then obviously when they're basically making fun of the Americans to their face, the Americans are cheering them on. He's clearly making a statement. Like, this isn't subtext, this is text.
Yeah, exactly. No. He hates America.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think he's got like a love-hate relationship with America, because film's certainly like inspired by a lot of American pop culture, and they're constantly sort of emulating Americanisms. So it's, I mean, one thing this, one film this kind of reminded me of that we talked about on the podcast before is Starship Troopers.
Ah,
like, partly that those, like, bright colors, but also just, like, the relationship between kind of being fascinated, but also sort of trying to undercut this media. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I think it was, I can't remember where I read it, but somebody was saying how, to them, like, Pierrot Le Fou was just about two people who watched too much American TV and movies and decided to like run off thinking that's how love is supposed to be, but
it'll rot your brains.
I don't know, like I think Godard, like there's times when it almost feels like you're trapped in the room with like the condescending guy wearing the Che Guevara t-shirt, but then he'll just undercut himself, and like that kind of makes it interesting or clever. Like I think he's self-critical enough that I don't find it insufferable.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, at this point, the Godardisms have become kind of cliche. Like, we know roughly what to expect from a Godard film, which is that it's going to somehow comment on the media itself. And he has countless imitators. But there's something groundbreaking when you think back to this would have come out in 1965, 66, and people watching this, like, it's one thing to play with the form in 1959, as he did in Breathless, where it's just kind of playing with gangster genre cliches. But in this, he'd become such a huge star, he's able to kind of comment and play with conventions of a Godard film. Right. So, like, this is the most effective parody of a Godard film that I've seen.
He made memes out of his own movie.
It's true.
Like, the fact that it comes sort of at the midpoint of the French New Wave, it almost feels like it's like a call to not become complacent in what they had already done, but to keep revolutionizing. Like, to me, it almost feels like, okay, we're halfway there. Let's keep going and let's keep pushing it. And because I think, like, at this point also, sort of French New Wave, you know, which was about breaking conventions, like, already had started to form its own conventions.
Yeah,
very much so.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be more artful when using a jump cut if people have already seen jump cuts, right? If people are used to jump cuts, what, you have to take it further, push it forward. And in some ways I think he was very successful in this film. In others, like, I personally, in my personal opinion, there are other more interesting uses of the Godard imagination. Like Alphaville just sort of using the negative. Like, all right. but that movie's so playful, and it does so much with what I see is so little. I don't know, I'm not exactly sure what the budget is on that. Or like Band of Outsiders. Like, that movie is hysterical.
In Band of Outsiders, I don't feel that same sort of distance that I do with this one.
Yeah.
Like his later 60s films, like, I can still sort of get invested in the story and the characters. And I guess it's deliberate that he's leaving that behind, but it's also just, as somebody who likes to watch movies, it's not the most fun.
Yeah. What do you think of Vive sa vie? Is that how vivre? I don't know. French.
Vivre sa vie? Like,
vivre sa vie. Thank you.
Yeah.
I think that one is amazing.
That one's really interesting.
Yeah.
Like, also that one too, it's sort of, I think it's broken up into like segments, right?
Yeah, it's like 12 different chapters.
Like, for some reason that makes it a little bit easier. Like, this one I think did sort of have chapters, but
Yeah.
It also just sort of feels like a stream of things just happening at you.
Yeah, true. But I think Vive la Zombie.
Bless you. You're trying because
what's the English title? Like, Her Life to Live?
My Life to Live. Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
But, like, that's sort of the. I've read, you know, talk of the Brechtian influence where there is this sort of remove from the audience, but it's effective in that, like, there is this distance from the character, but it's almost helpful to have that distance, and that's sort of also kind of part of the point where she becomes sort of almost dehumanized. But in this film, it's harder when you're dealing with romance, it's harder to become invested. But I feel like I've like been sounding that same note for a while now, but there are, like, the movie is really funny and it's beautiful to look at.
God, it's use of primary colors,
yeah,
even towards the end. Mm-hmm. The red, yellow,
right,
and blue.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredibly iconic.
Mm-hmm.
And we got, I'm assuming you got to see the restored version.
I hope so. I don't know. I got it.
Well, okay, so Cine Family had the restored version out for a couple weeks, and that was the version that I got to go see.
Oh, you went.
I did.
Oh,
on the very last night.
Nice.
So it was like last call, and my gosh, it was gorgeous. It was mm-hmm. much brighter than I remembered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Beautiful movie. It's true. Yeah. Do you have any favorite scenes you want to point out?
I love the scene where they're sitting in front of the blue door.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't really do much in front of it, but it's just so
the one
gorgeous.
Where they turn their heads at the
yeah.
same time. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
They're scheming.
And they're together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way that, like, in my mind's eye, I want to keep them there.
Yeah.
I might be a romantic at heart.
Maybe so. Yeah. Martin, how about you?
I love all the singing scenes, actually.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Also, the scissor stab scene is kind of like that.
That's a pretty good one.
If only because cool. I'm like a fan of Dial M for Murder. So.
Yeah, I know. Oh, I see what you did there.
Oh, I see you. That's a lot of this movie.
Yep.
Laurel and Hardy. Hey!
Yay! That's probably my favorite scene. I love that.
I learned this from Laurel and Hardy.
Yeah. Also, I love the scene where he's sitting on the island with the parrot on his shoulder.
Casually.
Yeah. They're natives now.
Well,
they've gone
like
native.
Strange,
they've gone
like,
so.
Little desert fox or some kind of
I know.
Creature.
Yeah.
It's very adorable.
It's about as much wildlife as they could sum up in the south of France.
Exactly. But yeah, that was like as far as playing with the genre cliche, like lost away on a hidden island, like that, how to do that on the cheap, like get a parrot and a weird fox, you got yourself a deserted island.
Yeah,
bam.
I think I saw somewhere the number for what cost them for production was something like only 300,000, which is almost nothing for a movie.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But considering all that they did with it.
Car crashes.
Yeah, a couple of car crashes.
Yeah.
Yeah, at least 4 cars are destroyed in that movie.
At least. Burned, too.
Yeah, exactly.
I
know. It's an audacious film. I mean, there's nothing like a Godard film. And while it's not my favorite of his filmography, I could see why others like it.
Sure. I mean, like, I think next to Breathless, this is probably the one I see most in other films.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't think of a film that has inspired, like, such a diverse group of other filmmakers. Like, when you see it, like, oh, it's a little bit of Pierre Lefou in Badlands or in Pulp Fiction or just like a really eclectic group of films.
Yeah.
Like,
Bonnie
I find that
Clyde.
Kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah. It's true. Influenced an eclectic group because he had. Eclecticism is kind of his brand, right? Like.
On brand.
Yeah. He's. Pulls from so many different sources, comic books, movies.
Philosophy,
precisely, yeah. So it makes sense that his reach would be equally eclectic. But yeah, Monica, what do you... So I should ask the question. This is the 43rd movie on the Sight and Sound list. Do you think it is worthy of the 43rd spot?
I do.
You do? 43? Yeah.
Is that the highest for a Godard film?
No.
Okay.
So we've had Breathless and Contempt already.
I don't know if I agree with Contempt, but I agree with Breathless. That's probably my favorite. And Pierre LeFou, a close second. Very close second.
Okay. All right. Martin, how about you?
How many Godard films are on the Sight and Sound list?
I think all of
list?
Them.
Like five?
No.
not 10, but...
Film socialism.
I think there's maybe 5 or 6, right?
We got another one coming up. History du cinéma. History.
I kind of think... I mean, I haven't seen Histoire du cinéma, so I don't know about that one, but I kind of wish Godard fans would consolidate their votes a little bit and
me
put...
Me too! Spread them out to other
You know, why not put Breathless in, like, top 10, and, you know, we'll all know how great Godard is, and we'll check out the rest of his stuff. You know, narrow it down to Breathless and Pierre Olifou.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, if I had any say, if it were up to me, I would say Breathless... Breathless is definitely in the correct spot. I believe it is in the top 20. But then we have Contempt a little further down the list. I would personally knock that off the list. but this one, I think I'd probably put it a little lower, put Band of Outsiders a little higher.
I see.
But, you know, it's really a matter of personal preference.
I wouldn't mind seeing some new Godard either. Like, I actually... enjoyed seeing Goodbye Language 3D
really?
And Film Socialism. Well, maybe not enjoyed, but I
yeah,
got
enjoyed is a strong word.
I like Goodbye Language, yeah. So I'm with you on that.
I like okay. Goodbye Language. Yeah, it's or it's interesting, Goodbye. Especially just, you know, the way it uses 3D and yeah.
Yeah,
love
yeah.
So, that.
Yeah, oh my God.
You know, maybe get some fresh Godard in. He's still making yeah. movies.
Why not? All right, I like it. We'll end on that. The 88th Annual Academy Awards are scheduled to be held this upcoming Sunday on February 28th. Last year, we did a whole special episode devoted to the Oscars, in which we attempted to pick the winners in every single category. But this year, we've decided to leave the punditry to the experts and talk more generally about some of the issues surrounding the ceremony. I don't know if you guys have heard, but there was a little controversy about some of the nominations, or perhaps I should say some of the non-nominations. We're going to talk briefly about the Academy's diversity problem, but also some of the other reasons for the growing antipathy towards the ceremony. All right. Monica, how are you feeling about this year's Oscars? Do you care?
I do care.
Okay.
I mean, overall, I'm lukewarm on most of the nominees, so that's very disappointing. But I am very interested in what Chris Rock is going to say at the ceremony, so I still want to tune in and... be there when it happens.
Mm-hmm. Are you someone who watches the Oscars every year?
I usually do. Yeah. Well, last year I like wrote about them and had to live blog for work. So there's been a while that I used to watch with my mom and then just graduated over to watching with friends. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it's something to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Martin, how about you? Are you excited about this year's Oscars?
More than I wish I was.
Okay.
I think, like, because it's such a big part of, I guess, the film industry, or Hollywood anyway, that it revolves around the Oscars, and there's all these films sort of made specifically for them, and it's such a big talking point, I kind of can't help myself. You know, it's like kind of like watching a bunch of political campaigns for people that you wouldn't vote for, but you're sort of interested, like, who's going to win or get the upper hand.
Oh, you mean like our elections right now?
I'm trying to stay away from that. yeah, I'm not gonna get it.
It's probably less contentious than the Oscars this year, right?
Slightly more polite.
But yeah, I am definitely someone who, in years past, has cared about the Oscars. I couldn't tell you why, because more often than not, I generally feel like they pick the wrong people, and they pick the wrong films. Mm-hmm. But... this year, I cannot work up much of any real enthusiasm for it. And I'm not super sure why, because this year, as with most years, it's equally non-diverse. It's like the same kinds of movies every single year. And I don't know, maybe it's just been called into relief this year because they didn't nominate my favorite movie of the year, but...
What was the one that you were hoping for?
Carol.
That's understandable.
Yeah, I thought it would get nominated. I don't know. But the fact that there are eight movies nominated for Best Picture, and I liked... I mean, I didn't see two of them, but I liked one of them. I mean, that's bad. And it wasn't even in my... I don't even know. But for the record, it's Mad Max. And it's not even... it didn't even make my top five. So I just generally just don't feel like they're reflective of my tastes. But that being said, I recognize that they are a somewhat important institution within the industry. And they've held this position of esteem for a really long time. I'm just not super sure that they are worthy of that esteem. But yeah, maybe let's just talk about maybe some of the issues that I'm sort of getting. Yeah, they have a representation problem, which they've taken steps to ameliorate. We'll see how effective it is. But Monica, you've talked about this and written about this, correct?
Quite a bit.
Yeah. So what's kind of your take? What do you think about this year's nominations in terms of the diversity issue and also the new steps to try and incorporate new people into the Academy and sort of get rid of some of the older people?
Wow, what are you saying? Get rid of some of the older people.
Hello over their face.
Let me clarify that a little bit. The issue with them is they're kind of these members who have been inactive for so long, they're kind of being put on notice. Like, you can get back into the fold, you can become an active member, you know, with these different steps, and you should qualify for them. And I almost kind of agree. After so, it's like, what, 10 years or something? Are you even seeing all of the movies if you're not if you're not participating in the industry? Because even I, as a critic who have to see a lot of these movies who get sent screeners for Critics Awards, there's just no human way that I get through all of them. And I'm pretty sure very few members of the Academy burn through their stack of screeners. Mm-hmm. So there's that problem. I was disappointed with the lack of diversity in this year's nominees, but it was the same thing last year when the whole hashtag #OscarsSoWhite started by April Rain. And now the conversation has been churning for over a year. And it's only just now that, I guess, mainstream media is paying attention to it, and it's become a hot-button issue. Now, all of a sudden, we're asking all of these older, established actors and directors about what they think about diversity in Hollywood, and they're basically confirming what we've all kind of suspected, is that they don't give this a second thought, because they're already in the door. They don't have their whiteness challenged, whereas there's a lot of creators, like, I can't imagine what Ryan Coogler and Michael B. Jordan for Creed are going through, or even like some of the cast of Straight Outta Compton. It's like, well, we made a very popular movie and hardly anyone is getting recognition for it.
Mm-hmm. True. When you think of the Academy and when you think of the Oscars, like, what kinds of movies typically get nominated and win? And do you think that it's reflective of the best movies of the year?
I don't think that the Academy should have the say-all, end-all on that. Like, this here stamps the best of this certain year, because they have gotten it wrong before. And besides, this is also subjective to begin with. And adding to that, there's a business behind campaigning, doing lunches, that whole screener stack that I talked about before, all these certain things the studios handle. So it's not even a mark of quality. It could just be like who got the most people in the door to see the one film that this one studio decided, here is my movie that I'm going to put in the horse race this year. Mm-hmm. And then what happens? The other movies get neglected.
Right. Exactly, yeah. And that's kind of part of why I've become so cynical about the awards, because I'm increasingly realizing it's not a meritocracy. It's about who throws the most money behind the movies.
It's oligarchy.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, that's a really cynical way to judge that.
It is,
know.
But it's also, it's one part a sort of temperature take on the industry as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that there's lack of diversity in the Academy, well, hello, there's lack of diversity in Hollywood. But it's also like a sort of brand, the Oscars. It is a brand. It isn't like a brand. It is a brand. And that still gets people into seats. That still piques people's interest. If I tell my mom that this movie won an Oscar, she's going to be a bit more interested in it than, I don't know, I never heard of this movie. Right. Is it any good? Mm-hmm. You know,
it's true. Yeah. And it's you're right. It's still a really powerful brand. But is it still a useful brand for most people, for your everyday moviegoer?
Well, that's the question that they're going to try and answer with changing their membership, because their membership does not reflect the average movie-going population.
Mm-hmm.
I think now we've seen that most moviegoers over-index people of color.
Mm-hmm.
I know specifically as speaking as Latino moviegoers, they're almost a quarter of the ticket-buying population, even though we're only 17% of the U.S. population. So the fact that we don't have Latino stars, we don't have Latino directors working consistently, that we're only seen on screen as stereotypes, and none of our stories make it past, you know, drug lord, sexy Latina mama, or, you know, fill your next stereotype mm-hmm. here, is really frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tiring.
Absolutely.
And unfortunately, where else do we have to spend our money when we go out as a family?
Mm-hmm.
So...
Exactly, yeah. Well, I'm glad people are calling attention to it. And if this, I mean, as we say, this is reflective of a larger problem within the industry. And how can people in the Academy be expected to vote on movies that aren't there? That being said, I think we can do slightly better than what happened this year. It's quite white. Quite white. And, like, I am someone who... I am kind of rooting for the Academy, because when I was a kid, I loved watching the awards, and it really meant something. And I do think it is useful for people to have this sort of curated assortment of movies that they can point to and say, this is the industry standard, literally.
Oscar nominee.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it should mean something. Oscar nominee should mean something.
It's a recognition from your peers.
Exactly.
As a filmmaker, as an actor, as a technician, or, you know, even producer.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big deal. And it still is treated as such.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah. But I think it's kind of my contention that it should... That either they need to shape up, or we need to... start regarding other different kinds of awards as being the more prestigious award.
I mean, that's sort of how I feel. Like, if they're not going to work to make themselves relevant, I don't think it's necessarily worth the effort of pressuring them to change. Or, you know, it's like, why bother? If somebody else is giving attention to films that are maybe more deserving or more interesting or more relevant, mm-hmm. You know, I think energy would be better spent put on that than... looking at the out-of-date Oscars.
My answer to that is I think that's only a temporary solution, because the bottom of the problem is that there's still not diversity in Hollywood in general.
Mm-hmm.
That's the biggest issue, is that we only have three movies that we could even nominate that have a diverse cast.
Mm-hmm.
That's a joke.
Yeah.
That doesn't even fill the 10 possible slots for mm-hmm. the year for Best Picture.
Yeah. What were you going to say, Martin?
It's also like, I think Hollywood, too, is running the risk of becoming irrelevant, and I don't necessarily
feel super invested
in most Hollywood films. So, I still watch as many films, but I'm getting them from other sources. And
right.
I'm like, my girlfriend should probably be on here instead of me, because she's like a more casual moviegoer and she's Black. And like, I don't think necessarily these films are just like, in any way appealing to her. You know, like, I could probably get her to go and see Mad Max, but that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they seem just, like, so far removed from, like, an average person's interest completely. Like, I don't know
Why does prestige to meet like older white male skewing? Right. You know, that's a really sure. Big
I mean,
issue.
And like the whole idea of like creating a movie specifically to win an Oscar, like the whole thing just seems so distasteful. And yeah. I hear a lot of people talking about like, oh, the state of films is so bad right now, and like it's not. The state of films is as good as it's ever been. It's mm-hmm. like the state of Hollywood, and
yeah,
like you know, sometimes it's like pulling teeth trying to get somebody to go and see you know, a film like Timbuktu or something like that that's mm-hmm. outside of that Hollywood campaigning,
right?
Hollywood promotion. But you know, I think a lot of people, once they do, find it very rewarding.
Yeah. And just so we're all aware, there is an alternative to the Academy Awards. We have the Independent Spirit Awards.
right.
And I just quickly would like to point out that for Best Picture, they nominated Anomalisa, Beast of No Nation, Carol, Spotlight, and Tangerine. That's a solid list. I didn't care for Spotlight, but sorry.
One of my favorites got on there. So better cross section of just like what people are watching and what people are excited about. Like,
yeah, like that just
I, like I love Tangerine, and like I found like nothing exciting in Bridge of Spies, you know.
It's, yeah,
yeah. Yeah,
exactly. So I mean, there are I'd say check your local critics list. You're probably more likely to find a more interesting, diverse group of movies than you will on the Academy Best Picture list. That being said,
I wouldn't guarantee that, but
yeah,
continue.
Yeah. That being said, I know we all kind of secretly care a lot, right? A little?
About the Oscars?
Yeah. In spite of ourselves. So this year's Best Picture nominees are The Big Short, Bridge of Spies, Brooklyn, Mad Max Fury Road, The Martian, The Revenant, Room, and Spotlight. Who do we think is going to win? We're placing bets.
Who I want to win?
Who do you want to win? Who's going to
who
win?
Who will win? Yeah. Is totally different. Because I am rooting for Mad Max Fury mm-hmm. Road, Brooklyn a close second.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that they're going
to
win.
Yeah. Who do you think is going to win? If you had to put money on.
Gosh, it's probably going to be between The Revenant and The Big Short.
Yeah, you think? Okay.
Or Spotlight. Yeah. Those are my
That sounds. Yeah, I agree completely with both things you said.
Yeah.
I'm glad we could agree.
Yeah. Pretty much. I mean, it's weird that no one. There's no like heavy favorite at this point.
No, I like Mad Max a lot, and it made it onto my top five list. But like, I'm not like the most passionate proponent of it. But I kind of wish maybe if it doesn't get Best Picture, I kind of wish George Miller and his wife Margaret Sixel would get award for Best Director and Best Editing, because I think those are sort of the exceptional things that maybe make it stand out, and I think it'd be kind of nice to see a husband-wife
that
team
would be lovely.
Get Oscars.
Yeah.
I think that'd be adorable.
So finally see George Miller recognized would be really interesting and unleash all of the Mad Max tweets.
Oscar that he won, right? Like, I think he got a Oscar for Happy Feet, maybe?
Did he get one for Howard?
I think he's got one for something. Babe
awesome.
Was nominated. Yeah. He's,
but come on, for the Mad Max franchise. Come on, pour one out for that.
I'm down. I like that. Like I said, it didn't make my top five, but that's...
It was my number one movie of the year.
Number one movie of the year, yeah. So, I mean, that's... But nevertheless, it is still my favorite movie that is nominated for Best Picture. However,
yes,
my money is on Spotlight. I'm going to go out on a limb and say Spotlight. Doing it, sure.
Think Spotlight's gonna steal it from The Revenant, like The Revenant's
winning
all the.
I don't know. It's gonna be.
I feel like it's gonna win
prize.
Just because, like, that's the one I like the least. That's
probably. You're probably right. Well, I just feel like because Birdman won last year, and so are they gonna give it to him twice?
It would be all the more frustrating.
I know. All right. Well, we shall see. We shall see. It seems the long arm of the law has finally caught up to us. But before we're hauled off to the big house, let's close out the show with a few final notes of positivity. Monica, what's one book, movie, musical thing, website thing that you've been digging lately? What's a thing you like?
What's a thing that I like? Well, I actually just rewatched Coming to America last night for the first time in a couple years. And gave me all the New York nostalgia, so that was lovely. And I completely forgot. Well, the funny thing was, we were looking for a movie to watch for Valentine's Day, and it was right towards the top of the list for romantic movies. And I'm like, we have to watch this.
Obviously.
And yeah, it's totally about him finding his queen. It's Eddie Murphy. He's top of his game in this one, and I just absolutely loved it. And of course, I didn't realize it because I'd seen it so many years back, but there's a Trading Places reference with, I think it's Randolph and Mortimer make an appearance in Coming to America, and I just started screaming, oh my God!
Gotta love it.
Yeah. Brought me joy.
I love Coming to America. Great immigrant story. Right.
It's true. Beautiful, really. Martin, how about you?
I just saw a film called The Carrier, which was written by my friend Helen Kingston. It's like a British horror movie set on an airplane. And I think it's super cool. And if you want something that's just as far away from an awards movie as possible, but it's totally enjoyable, I'd recommend people check out The Carrier.
All right. Very cool. I dig it. I have a movie, too. I finally got around to watching Chi-Rock, the Spike Lee movie from 2015. Oh, yeah. And I thought it was awesome.
I dug it. I still have to get to it.
It's got buff Dave Chappelle.
Yeah, it does.
It's kind of scary.
Yeah. It shouldn't work. It's an adaptation of a Greek play.
Lysistrata.
Yeah. Yeah, it shouldn't work. It's all told in, I'm not sure what the rhyme scheme is, but the whole thing rhymes. It's Samuel L. Jackson plays the chorus, and it's kind of amazing. I'm like, it really could have been a disaster, but I think it really works, and it's really funny, and it's also really poignant. So check it out. Speaking of potential things that could have been nominated for Oscars but weren't, Angela Bassett needs to be in more things also.
Oh my God, she's great.
Isn't she? She's so amazing. Yes. Like, come on, get with it, people.
Spike Lee should follow it up with an adaptation of The Back Eye. That would be pretty great.
Of what?
The Back Eye. It's a Euripides joke. Never mind.
There you go. Yeah. Sorry. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, what's your favorite Godard film? Come let us know on our website, flickswise.com, or you can follow us and leave us a comment on Facebook at facebook.com/flickswise. And don't be a bourgeois square. Come hang with me and the rest of my film Twitter pals. The handle is @flickswise. But before you do all of that, please kowtow to the great lords of capitalism and give us a nice rating on iTunes. Don't even have to give us money for paid in comments. On our next show, I believe we have Jacques Tati's Playtime for the next entry on the Sight and Sound list. So hope you like silly sound effects. But until then, Monica, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And if people want to find your work on the internet, where should they go?
They should follow me on Twitter at @mcastimovies, M-C-A-S-T-I movies.
And we didn't get into it. Where are you writing these days?
Oh, my goodness. So many different places.
I couldn't. There wasn't time.
Right. Goodness. RogerEbert.com, Tribeca Film, International Business Times, Pace Magazine. I'm a busy girl. Mm-hmm. And I'm also a USC grad student over in their School of Journalism. And on the first film critic fellowship that they have there, and they're trying to find a new candidate. So if you are interested, send me, tweet me, ask me questions.
Wow. You don't know what you're inviting. All right. Martin, thank you as always.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be on, even if I'm talking about Godard.
If you must. thank you for lowering yourself.
I'm a
for deigning to talk about Godard with us. All right, I guess, shall we end it all here? Blaze of glory?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh. Boom.
Oh, yes. Hollywood.